Okay, we can begin. Today is November 13th, 2017, a beautiful Monday morning here in Yerushalayim. I want to make one correction. I've used the word incorrectly, evidently from time immemorial, because I could swear that that's what I heard when I was a kid. I was corrected last week by one of the guests that came, and the word is idiosyncratic. A person is idiosyncratic. It's a very hard word for me to master because I heard something else, but we checked it out from Webster's Unabridged, and idiosyncratic is correct. So do me a favor, Mel Barinholtz corrected me. If I ever use the word incorrectly, please correct me because I can't even pronounce it. It's beyond me. Okay. Down to work. We have a very fascinating shiur today, and I want to pass on a lot of knowledge and want you to feel the problems. But, all right, the Igudas HaRabbanim, the convention, their first meeting, planning this tremendous program, and you got to give credit because the ideas they raised 115 years ago, these are ideas which are just as much in the vogue today. There's no question a central issue like civil marriage, it's different than Kashrut or Shabbat. What we do, we wear a black hat, we don't wear a black hat, we wear a yarmulke this way, that way, we wear a chveis, a bekesh, it's a personal decision. But nesuin esrachiyim, civil marriage, affects every Jew no matter where he is. And this is very important. It's not a topic to deal with now. But you're aware that with the flock of Balei Tshuva, the problem runs back and forth. Many people have a shaila of Mamzeret. It's not just Russia today, it's America. And Baruch Hashem, Klal Yisrael paskens like Reb Moshe. We didn't pasken like Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. And you'll even see the latest volume of Rav Ovadia Yosef that I'll talk about in class in more detail on Mamzeret. I wanna talk again, maybe a whole shiur, add an addendum to what I've taught over the decades and what I've published, because this is all new material. But the Rav Ovadia takes for granted, Nisuin Esrachiyim does not count, and b'diavad we can be matir how to remarry. We certainly can be matir the children. Even the Rav agreed to that. But this was a question that was bitterly fought, and not every little rabbi and every little shtetl can decide on his own. And that was a beautiful idea for the Igudas HaRabbanim. I don't think it ever really got off the floor in the sense that even in Europe, when Rav Avraham Dovber, Kahana Shapiro wanted to do it in Europe in the 30s, it's just, even today in Israel, can you get all the rabbis to agree? You understand? Unfortunately, we're so split and there's so much machlokes. Every camp you look into, you find machlokes. The only thing I will say, maybe I'm prejudiced, but for the so-called Mizrahi element, that there are differences of opinion, absolutely, but at least the machloket is not brutal, it's more sophisticated. This is the feeling I have. But when you look what's going on in Panovich and you see what's going on in the Shas world, you can understand here's Machlokes b'fnei yam v'yadav. People are taking their cameras and videoing kids throwing students in Panovich throwing gil eshel what I don't know what they call it in English, sour cream at Rosh Yeshivas that they don't approve of. I mean, this is unbelievable. And then it's shown on TV, it's picked up on YouTube. Before you know it, it's all over the world. So unfortunately, we haven't been able to achieve that. You see, there was a serious move underway in the early 50s, the State of Israel, and again, it's not for now to go into full detail, but just to continue this theme, with the State of Israel, there was a certain apocryphal feeling that was launched in the Torah world and the Jewish world. And as you know, even Agudat Yisrael joined in the first election. Could you imagine going back, 49, I believe it was, the first election, Aguda and Mizrahi ran together, ran a joint ticket. I told you this was the mistake when I read the book, Live Torah, Love Torah, Learn Torah. the biography of Rav Teitz by his daughter, married to my chaver, married to Cherry Blau. Beautiful, beautiful Rivka Blau, Rivka Teitz Blau. Beautiful piece of work. And for, she wrote it, you know, it's, you can't get a doctorate if you're writing about your own father, obviously. My doctorate has been canceled. I had to resubmit Silva. I wrote about my own cousin, a blood relative. I found it out 50 years later. But it's a very honest piece of work. But I told her, you have one mistake. She tells the story there that her father, her mother always would yell at her father not to waste his time in politics. You have to be a rub, you have to learn, you have to teach, you have to preach. Do good things, don't waste your time in politics. And she says, whenever he got involved in a good of politics, Mizrahi politics, her mother was very upset. So, and she says, my mother was always right, it was a waste of time. And with the election, he tried to unite the Mizrahi, the Agud, and he got nowhere. I said, in 49, he got very far. They ran a joint ticket. She checked it out. She called me back. She said, Ani, you're right. They ran a joint ticket in 49. No one can believe it. Of course, today, imagine, could you see the Aguda leaders, the Galhatera, the Hasidic leaders? I tell you, I could see sitting with the Mizrahi leaders. It's not a problem. The Hasidic Yidden have a different approach. But the Degel HaTeira, if you don't have a proper Hashkafa, it's not correct, it's incorrect. Kedei Siklut Mizrahi, but when the state was established, it created this tremendous, wonderful feeling. Is Shein Mashiach Zeit, it's almost Mashiach time, yeah, that feeling. And part of it later was to organize a world conference of Rabbanim. This was the dream later with Heichal Shlomo, and you see, it never got off the floor. Why? Because they were frightened going to Heichal Shlomo. It's once a beautiful, when I came in Aliyah, it was a very important building. Today, it's not even in the tour books, Heichal Shlomo. It's Herzog College, Rabbi Berman, our president, my dear student, was heading up, he was going to revitalize Heichal Shlomo, but all right, he went to America, Washington Heights, he has an important calling there. But if you go into Heichal Shlomo, ask him to show you the room that was built for the chief rabbinate, for the Beit Din HaGadol Le'Irurim, the top Beit Din in Israel. No, can anyone tell me how it was built? Semi-circle. Can anyone tell me what that reminds you of? Semi-circle, Lishkat HaSanhedrin, so that you can see each other's faces, because that's very important when you're debating. If only I had a halachic topic, built in a semi-circle. Unbelievable. And they're worried still, if you're going to hold a conference in Heichal Shlomo, before you know it, there'll be a Sanhedrin. And once you talk about a Sanhedrin, they're worried there'll be an ovation. You already go back to Napoleon's Sanhedrin. Remember, we lectured on it maybe 20 years ago. Napoleon's Sanhedrin, which again is one of the most fascinating topics you will ever touch. Because the Sanhedrin consisted of Gedolei Yisrael. But Napoleon gave them 12 questions. Not so simple. If Napoleon offers you his daughter in marriage, what's your response? You follow me? Napoleon didn't exactly ask that, but he asked very simply, how do you view marriage that's according to the laws of France? And he put the Sanhedrin had to double talk him. They couldn't say the marriage is worthless, horrible, terrible. The marriage is recognized. The government recognizes it, but it's not a marriage with the sanctity of Judaism, all right? Napoleon could accept that, but there's a lot more. But that's what they were worried about. But this concept, it's a beautiful concept, but unfortunately, we don't have Shalom V'Achva in our ranks. I need not tell you, look at look at Rav Urbach, and look at Rav Kanievsky, look at Rav Steinman, look at Panovich, look what's going on right before our eyes today. Okay. So, and then they spoke in terms of not going to secular court. They spoke in terms of Rabbanim respecting other Rabbanim. There should be peace. They spoke in terms of titles. And they never would give Rav Haraf HaGaon, because the minute you get around in titles, who can say who's what? And some people are very self-centered and very upset. And I can learn better. Oh, what went on? So they solved the problem. Hechaver Harav. Harav Hechaver. Everyone gets the same title. All right, but now I want to go further. And here, they came to a different topic. And it says here on page 28, very interesting, that they couldn't decide a definite answer to this topic because the Rabbanim could no longer stay in New York. They had to go back to the Shtelas. Now here too, you have an interesting comment on life. When the RCA used to have conventions, I don't know if they have conventions anymore. I think everything is done over the internet. I don't know exactly how it works, but the RCA used to have two conventions a year. In the middle of the winter, that was the semi-annual, and then the annual, the big one, was in June. The conventions would be scheduled like Monday through Thursday. Why Monday through Thursday? Because the Rabbanim had to go back to their Kehillah. And Rabbi, and you should know, the Balabatim have a good case. The Shabbos, they need the Rav. Who knows? They have a Bar Mitzvah, they have a Nufrav. They have Shilas, they want to hear a Drasha. So that's what happened here. The Rabbanim had to leave. They couldn't remain in New York. So the last topic, which they left in the hands of a committee, was a topic that haunts us until today. Tzedakah, charity, people coming around. New, have you ever been in Chutz Laretz on a Sunday morning? All I can tell you is I've been in Australia, I've been in South Africa, I've been in Canada, I've been in the five towns, the United States, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, Sadna the Ara Chadhu. If you have a reputation that you have a little money and you're about tzedakah, from 10 o'clock on, people are knocking at your door. It's become a whole profession. I mean, I can tell you, you come to a strange country, you hire a driver, he gets a percentage. If you want to play the role of a Rebbe, you hire a Gabbai. I saw this with my own eyes. I was playing, I was in Lawrence. I'll give you one example just to bring it to life, but I saw it all over the world. I was in Lawrence. So suddenly, I'm inside watching the Met game with the Rosh Yeshiva of Kerem Biafna, Rav Goldvich. I'm trying to teach him baseball. I challenged him. I said, "Vikend design as the Kerem Biafna Rosh Yeshiva was learned American kind of Kenish baseball." So he said, "We were very good friends. It's a whole story. We were very close. His daughter was one of my first students in Mechola. Yiddish Amada." No, with the Rosh Yeshiva I spoke Yiddish. What do you want out of me? We were both, see, he was speaking his native language and I was speaking my native Torah language. So he said to me, "Let it be ice." So we turned on the, so I remember, suddenly I hear a knock at the door. I opened the door, I recognized this guy, a panhandler from Mata's stuff, I don't go into more detail, and a gate with a shtek in a silver aryeh, silver stick, you understand, via Rebbe, and a Houghton Hunt, he's holding in his hand, Noam Elimelech, and a gate with a gabbai, and I say, that while the bus is in back playing tennis, goes around the back, and whatever happens, and he gives him a check, I think $180. I said to him later, "Barry, are you crazy? This guy is a phony from day one. He hires a gabbai, he hires a driver." He says, "It was worth the act to pay for the front seat." You understand? This is about tzedakah, not like a poor guy like me looking. But you see, this raises the entire issue that points us up to today. How do you know someone is legitimate? And I have to tell you, already 100-plus years ago, they proposed a solution that in some communities, like for instance, I know in Chicago, I know in Toronto, I know Baltimore, I know in London. Where else? Teaneck. I know that they proposed that you have to have a committee in every city of Rabbanim. And when someone wants to collect charity, they have to go to the committee and get an authorization from them. And they proposed this. And 100+ years ago, I need not tell you that this issue was settled, not settled. There's no way you can totally control it, but there are cities today where they're very, very careful. B'didi HaVeYuvna in Queens, where it's Hefka, and Brooklyn, where it's Hefka. What happened to me in Queens, I was in the Shtibel on Bly Street. My friend from Lakewood, Rosen, what's his name? Not Rosenblum. What's the name of the great Chazan? Yesel Rosenblatt. His name is Getzel Rosenblatt. So I was in Getzel. You know, I'm talking about the Shtibel on Bly place. Mincha and Mariv every half hour. All afternoon mincha and Mariv could be until 12 midnight every half hour. So he married a girl from B'nai Akiva, married someone I know, Telma, a fabulous guy. No youngster anymore, we're all on in years. And he was a good friend of Meir Kahana, and I knew him, he was the Baal Menagin. When I learned in Lakewood, he was the Baal Menagin. Shabbos, mincha, not mincha, Shalosh Shudos, he would sing a niggin. So I'm standing there, I got there a little early, I'm learning, I have a sefer, and I see this guy from Israel, and he's carrying on, and giving a hard luck story. And I tell you, I was offended. I said to him, you have Bituach Lumi in Israel. Everyone is covered. All operations are covered. No one has to pay out of their pockets. What are you talking about here? So the guy disappeared. Follow me? He came back probably the minion after the minion I davened at. But that's so phony. It's beyond words. But people respond, Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim. So the idea was a wonderful idea, but it never got off the floor totally. We'll see what happens later. One of the greatest achievements of Agudat Rabbanim was after World War I with the Central Relief, with the drive for Yeshivat in Palestine. We'll talk about that in detail. And there you see organization paid off. But this is a challenge, a tremendous challenge in America. And it can never be perfect. No matter what you do, it can never be perfect. In London, they actually give out script. People buy script. Do you have that in America?
I saw it in London.
I saw it in London. I was very impressed. And you buy the script. It's all tax deductible. And you give them script. And then they have to redeem it with the committee that authorizes them to collect. Very well organized. But English Jewry is well organized. And it can do it there because of the conservative small c traditions. It's a different country than America. Okay. So what they left afterwards was an executive committee, and I'll just mention a few of the names because these are names that interact in our world. First of all, on the executive committee, the chairperson, honorary person, was Rav Lessa of Cincinnati. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that Rav Yaakov Gershom Lessa was the leading rabbinic figure in this world. He was a Volozhin, a Talmud from the early Volozhin years. He was a Rav Muvhak, Gittin, Kedushin, Chalitza, Geira. Everyone was Samach on him, but he was already older, and he was from Cincinnati, which of course presents a problem. You're not from the heart of it, New York. But he was the honorary chairman. Among the others, I'll mention the name of Shalom Elchanan Yaffa. He was a Rav in New York. I'll tell you where his name, he played a role in Yeshiva Yitzchak Elchanan, but I'll tell you where his name comes up in Torah history. When I was growing up, all of you know, the Rav spoke about it, I've quoted the Rav 1,000 times over. There were 3 big Rabbonim in New York, Rabbis Lukstein, Young, and Goldstein. So Lukstein was a musmach of the yeshiva, Zawi yeshiva, he was Chalchanan. Rabbi Young was a musmach from Europe, from rabbinic seminaries. All right, fine. No one was going to question Rabbi Young smicha. Rabbi Goldstein, Harry Fischel's son-in-law, was a graduate of JTS, the seminary. No. You'll see already, people were murmuring against JTS from the 1890s on. So he always told people when they asked him where he got smicha, he got smicha from Rav Shalom Elchanan Yaffe. It was a private smicha. But he said, I have an Orthodox smicha, and he was correct. By the way, you should know that of the three Rabbanim, Rabbis Goldstein, Young, and who am I missing? Lichtstein, the most elich, they used to say, was Rabbi Goldstein. You follow? The most elich was Rabbi Goldstein. So you can't put him down. And he was taka. I had the privilege of studying with him and teaching members of his family afterwards. He was very, very elich. But he used to say, smicha, Rabbi Yaffe. Would never mention JTS. Of course, the other Rabbanim on the committee were names that you know. For instance, Ramaz Margolis, Moshe Zvulun Margolis. He was a heavyweight then in Boston, shortly to move to New York. Rav Dov Aryeh Cohen Leventhal, who you all heard the name, the Rebbe of Philadelphia, he created two presidents of Yeshiva University as we know it today. The first president, my cousin, Rabbi Dr. Dov Revel, who made him president? Who made him known on the American scene? Who adopted him? Who took him under his wings? Rav Dov Aryeh Cohen Leventhal. Rabbi Belkin, Rav Shmuel Belkin, Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin. He became president. A key role in his becoming president was that he married the granddaughter. He married Selma Ehrlich. She was the granddaughter of Rav Leventhal. Rav Leventhal's daughter was married to Ehrlich. He was a businessman. This was his daughter. She married Dr. Belkin, and he had a great supporter for the presidency in Rabbi Leventhal. Another member of the executive committee was Rav Moshe Shimon Zivitz. All right, how many of you have heard of the name? Reed Revel, very important name. He was the Rav of Pittsburgh. A great time. These people were great Talmid Chachamim. Don't think these weren't first-rate Talmidei Chachamim. He wrote in Yerushalmi. He was the Rav of Pittsburgh. He made, Reb Moshe Bick used these words when he was talking with me, he made the first shidduch in America. That shidduch gives us Yeshivas Rebbe Shchol Chanan. The shidduch was very simple. Rabbi Leventhal, when Rabbi Revel came to America, he came to Yeshivas Rebbe Shchol Chanan. It was a halfway house. It was an absorption center. So Rabbi Leventhal would come once a week to speak with the students, see what's going on, come in from Philadelphia. It wasn't that far. There was a train already. So when Rabbi Revel came, Rabbi Belkin, Rabbi Leventhal meets him, and he sees, you know, all of Shas already. He had a photographic memory. He knew every Tosfot. I can tell you, Rabbi Volk once told the story that Rabbi Revel, this is 39, when Rabbi Volk started teaching in the yeshiva, Rabbi Revel had a kinship for him because they were both Telze. So Rabbi Revel came in to hear him teach, see who this new Rosh Yeshiva is. And they got involved in a machlokes over Tosfot, and Rabbi Revel said, Maman Daf Kukin, and he quoted from a different Tosfos in Shas, and Rabbi Volk said, Nein, tz nisht richtig, a little kid telling Rabbi Revel. So they said, let's get the Gemara. They sent the kid to the library, bring a Gemara, the Gemara they needed. And they didn't have, like today, you sit here with all of Shas and all of the Rambam on your desk. Then you had to run to the Gottesman, send the Shikyngel to bring it back. They opened up the Tosfot, and Rabbi Volk was right. And Rabbi Revel broke into tears. Rabbi Volk told me this with no concept that one day I'm going to write about Rabbi Revel. He told me this, let's say, 56, let's say, 55, 56. And he told me, Rabbi Revel broke into tears and said, Ich bin the Rosh Yeshiva mit the Nasi, and mein ganze Leben is kleiben Geld to pull together money. Ich werd vergessen alle Teisus in was ich gekannt und ganz Schass. He knew it all by heart, you see? And this was Revel. So Rabbi Leventhal pulls him out of the yeshiva, brings him to Philadelphia. He winds up getting a master's, a doctorate. And he's getting experience, the American rabbinate. Now, there was a little community in Marietta, Ohio. Marietta, Ohio didn't have its own Rav. It had a little community. There was a Talmud in this Kollel, Muscat, Rabbi Muscat, Jonathan Muscat. He's a Rav today in Oceanside. Recognize the name? There's another Muscat. So his great-great-grandfather, if I have it right, was a medical doctor in Tulsa, and a Frumi Yid, and he was one of the mainstays of the shul with the Travis family. And Rabbi Zivitz would visit every few months as the Shilas, Nachman Paskin, and the Travis family has this girl, Chaya Sara. She was born Pashat Chaya Sara, and she's 18, 19 years of age, and from public school girl, real Elich of Frumkeit, if you've heard my stories over the years, not a sophisticated Stern College graduate who can tell you the ins and outs, what you can do, what you can't do. She was from, and medafah yehaben hashidach. So Rabbi Zivitz says, "Ich ken a junger man in, I know a young man in Philadelphia. Let me talk with him." And he talks with Rabbi Leventhal, and Rabbi Leventhal tells Bernard Rebel, "We have a shidduch in Marietta, Ohio, on Thanksgiving Day, 1908." He goes to visit her in Marietta, Ohio, and the shidduch is soon made between Bernard and Chaya Sara Revel. Why was that shidduch so important? Because at that point it was a very wealthy family, the Travis family, oil, the petroleum business. And that gave Rabbi Revel the chance to come back to New York when they pleaded with him to head up the new yeshiva, to build a high school. He did not take a salary, and no one could tell him what to do. Totally independent due to his brother-in-law and the Travis family connection. So you see, these were the people that the Vav HaPoel, and they got to work. Now, all over Europe, the rabbinic journals, tremendous articles appeared about the Agudas HaRabbanim. And the greatest achievement is what Yitzchak referred to a week ago, that all these articles said, we now have in America an organization that is not an organization of reverence. These are legitimate rabbanim. And all religious undertakings, interactions, necessities, call it religious business, everything now has to go through the Agudas HaRabbanim. These are Rabbanim. These are people we can depend upon. These are people of our own ilk. Talmidei Chachamim, Yoreim and Shleimim, Yurapeisha. And over the world, they were rejoicing. On the local scene, opposition immediately developed from two sources. One source, which lives on until today, and it's part of the Jewish, I would say, curse in the free world. Immediately, there are people who are jealous, who are offended. I didn't get mafta, I didn't get shlishi, I didn't get the title Harav HaGon. So just like with RJJ, there was opposition. There were Rabbanim in America who laughed, we are smarter than the Agudas Rabbanim, we don't need the Agudas Rabbanim, we can give a heksha. And this remains with us until today. It's here on the Israeli scene today as well, unfortunately. The other opposition, of course, came from JTS. Now, JTS, again, I stress this, I've stated this, I stress it again. At this moment in time, JTS would have fallen apart. In order to be successful, Morty just told me before class, he met a Talmud of mine from the early 70s who has been successful financially in Israel. Fine. I think I know what he does, but let's give an example. You want to sell a product. In order to sell a product, you have to have people who need it. You know, I'm going to come up with some fancy product no one in the world is interested. Big deal. Need people. People import candy to Israel. I often wonder, why do you have to import candy? The candy make here is fabulous, but, you know, Jews want a taste from all over the world. All right, you bring in marshmallows from Manchester. Wartime is Heksha. They're fabulous. They're before Pesach, you see how much sells. We're talking importers. There's a product. People want it. Fine. Good. JTS was established to fight the reform, to produce an American Orthodox rabbi. By 1900, no one was interested in them. The kids who were growing up already were just as happy to go into a Reform temple, more or less. But the masses, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Yudapeyashi Yidden who came and looked at these rabbis, these are rabbis, Amayaret, what do they know? Ich kann besser lernen, I can learn more. How much Gemara do they know? And JTS, there's memoir literature that in the original JTS building, by 1900, people visited, windows were broken. There's no money to fix. Dilapidated, run down. It would have gone off the map. But Jacob Schiff, and we've spoken about him in great detail, I don't want to repeat myself, but Jacob Schiff, who was a mixed-up character, he was a hybrid, he was Shatnas. He grew up on the lap of Rav Shimshra Ful Hirsch in Frankfurt. Till his dying day, he was in Machalos Shabbos. He was makpid on kashrut. He washed until a jadayim. He benched. And he was president of Temple Emmanuel. All right, go and put that together. You know the famous story, which is absolutely true, how they met him one morning. They see this beautiful carriage parked with its horses waiting outside the Beis Medrash HaGadla on Norfolk Street, east side. And they say, who can be coming here? What's this, Rothschild? They go into the shul, and Dotten Davent is Jacob Schiff with a Talis Ibizain cup, and they say, Mr. Schiff, what are you doing here? You're president of Temple Emmanuel. And he's the classic answer, I have Yotzeit for my mother today. I should keep the Yotzeit in Temple Emmanuel? I can't do that in my mother's memory. And Mr. Schiff, his kids write in their memoirs. His kids were very famous. Dorothy Schiff, New York Post editor, owner. So he used to go check that the kids are kashering their homes for Pesach. He used to make a Seder, everything. And he was President of Temple Emmanuel. He came in to JTS 1902 and he said, I don't want you to go out of business. I'm using his words now. We need an enlightened orthodoxy here. And he put money on the table. He's not a poor Jew. He plays a very, very big role in Torah history because many attribute Shanghai and the Japanese attitude that they didn't kill the Jews and move them from Kobe to Shanghai to Mr. Schiff because he got the banks to lend Japan a fortune of money in the Russo-Japanese War. He wanted to get even with Russia because of the pogroms and the hatred and the enmity and the persecution of the Jews. Am I right, Yitzchak? You know what I'm talking about. So they attribute to Mr. Shifik, and this probably is true. The more you read, the more you see what happened, Bidei Hashem, you have to thank Mr. Schiff that we're sitting here today. Mir Yeshiva, Shanghai, Mr. Schiff. So he put money on the table, and he brings to America Solomon Schechter. Solomon Schechter was a fabulous choice from his point of view. Solomon Schechter, Shmuel Zalman Schechter, at gestammt from a Hasidische home. He came from a Hasidische home, you understand. His father was a Schechter, Hasidish. He broadened Cambridge, I don't have to tell you, and all that went on with Egypt, with the Geniza and Fustat. And he became world famous, and he the title enlightened Orthodox Jew could probably be very well applied to him. He certainly was orthoprax. He was not entirely orthodox. And I don't want to go further because it would take me hours. I think you've heard me lecture about this decades ago in great detail. Catholic Israel, this was his baby that ultimately Catholic Israel decides. It's not the Rabbanim, it's the practice of the people. Well, if you, and there's a lot of truth to this. Charlie, I don't want to tell you he's wrong. There's a lot of truth to it. But who decides? People who are from, who are concerned. You can't go into a shul and take the mechitza down and say the people voted. You follow? Catholic Israel. You know what Catholic Israel means? Universal Israel. The universal body of the Jewish people, they decide. So now the seminary, beginning with 1902, 1903, 1904, it starts to shift a little. There, it's, if I can make the comparison, it's like Chovevei Torah today. The faculty is many different types of people, but many of them are more enlightened, so-called. I know, and they'll express views that a frum Jew, even a guy like Rekefid, who's far from being an extremist, has a lot of difficulty swallowing some of the points of view you hear from some faculty members at Chovevei Torah, including my own students who are faculty members there. So JTS, the Akudas Rabbanu, comes on the scene. This is 1902, 1903. They already are attacking JTS at every opportunity. And JTS, of course, looks at the Agudas HaRabbanim. These are a bunch of people from the old shtet. This is outlandish, outmodish. It will disappear. It's not going to last very long. And this rivalry, this enmity, begins at that point. I need not tell you it continues for many, many decades afterwards. Now, the Agudas HaRabbanim had two success stories, one with major implications, one I would say it's like winning a game but you don't win the World Series. The one with major implications was following the death of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. They established the yeshiva on the east side of New York, named in memory of the chief rabbi. The Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, or RJJ, is probably the Agudas HaRabbanim's greatest achievement, I would say, until the end of World War I. Afterwards, there may be greater achievements in helping Russia, helping European and Palestinian Jewry. But RJJ, you see, this was a day school that became massive and caught on. It was a pace setter. The Eitz Chaim, which later merges with Yeshiva Shmuel Chanan, becomes an elite school. As time marches on, it no longer has the first six grades. It has the seventh grade, the eighth grade, the high school age, but the elementary is RJJ. And it's a who's who in who went to RJJ, from good to bad. Everyone likes to quote the gangsters who were electrocuted in the electric chair. Some of them were RJJ graduates, that's correct, but you can't blame RJJ. These were the times. The parents wanted the kids to be from, wanted the kids to know, and you know, there were gangsters who wouldn't kill on Shabbos. This is documented. One gangster, well known, he was a hitman for the mafia, but he would not kill on Shabbos. There were many books. Siegel was an RJJ graduate. There's a whole list you can type out of RJJ. But on the other hand, many people, their whole frumkeit, the whole continuity, this is before Torah Vadas, this is before Chaim Berlin, RJJ. Not only that, after World War II, RJJ took in hundreds and hundreds of survivors. They didn't charge any tuition. Am I right or wrong, Vic? I mean, this you have to pay credit. Chinam ein kesef. Some of them went on to become very famous. Krauthammer, the brothers, one of them was a very famous columnist, political scientist. They went to RJJ. I can tell you, I'll give you an example from a family that I know close, the Gluck family, G-L-U-C-K. It's a family that at one time all four brothers lived in Woodmere. So this is a family was saved by Wallenberg, Raoul Wallenberg. They were Hungarians. and they headed for Budapest. They headed their stories. They were on the train. Nazis were asking for their identity. A man sitting there, a total stranger, said, no, this is my wife and these are my children. And it was unbelievable how they reached the safe house. Then they're in the safe house. And right at the end of the war, with the Russians approaching, the Nazis went right into the safe house and lined up Jews and started to shoot. They killed one Jew. They're about to shoot the second Jew. The Glucks are next in line, and the Russians burst in, and they kill every German soldier in sight. You know, the Germans prayed they should be conquered by the Americans, not by the Russians. You can understand why. And by the way, I like the Russians better than the Americans on that level. So the family comes to America. Now, here's a man who was a businessman in Budapest. He comes to America, they're penniless. What do they have? They have to get organized, have to get settled. This is Yesh Me'ayin. You should know, three boys are alive at the time. The fourth isn't born yet. All three go to RJJ, okay? Chinam Ein Kesef. Now it reaches high school age. This is the cute part of the story. I just told the story in a family simcha there. They reach high school age. So the father is on the west side already. He's reestablished, doing a little business. There's money, reparations, whatever. So the first two boys went to RJJ. They were still struggling. The third boy, it's a time the family is doing better. He goes to MTA. The fourth boy, born in America, now the family is doing very well. Take a guess where he goes to school. Ramaz. Now, 60 years later, I have a simple question. Four brothers, two RJJ graduates, one MTA graduate, one Ramaz graduate. Aryeh, who wears the black hat? The Ramaz graduate. That's exactly right. But the beauty, I taught members, each one in the family, I taught children from each, all four stayed from. One lives in Beit Shemesh to be near his daughter, who was my student, married to a rabbi, to a Ritz Musmach. The kids are raised in a world totally, totally right-wing. I think they're nine children. I tell George, I say, you got to keep on working. And every kid, they marry, they support them. So Baruch Hashem, all from 100%. But the black hat, that's the one who lives in Lawrence. He's the one from Ramaz. But they're wonderful. You don't know what fine, wonderful people they are. I can tell you more. I'll take one more second. You should know what type of Jews went to RJJ. The second brother, not the eldest, but number two, was a very gifted hockey player. He could have been professional. He had all types of offers, and he couldn't do it. He said, how could I hurt my father? Shabbat Kashrut. How can you observe? You should know he continued to play amateur hockey, I think until today. He's exactly my age. It's his birthday in a few weeks, in 10 days. I think until today he still plays hockey. One time he scored a goal, and when you score a goal, you get the puck, it's called. And he dedicated, I have the puck in my library with a whole letter of dedication. But this was RJJ. That was an achievement. Now I want to come to the heart of today's lecture, and from this point on, it's very fascinating, and I want to show you the total picture. Another thing that they accomplished was they brought peace to Chicago. That's one machloket that it ended, it didn't end, it continued. Ultimately, it brought peace. I said it was a victory, but it's not the World Series, meaning that the problems of Kashrut Levon continue. Today is much better, but it's something that's not totally solved, because no one, Ish HaYashavi and Av Yaseh, no one can force Kashrut down anyone's throat, and no one can force standards. And you see with the State of Israel, where we have an organized rabbinate, right now we're caught up in the maelstrom. What will be with Kashrut in Israel? Now, I want to go into a little bit detail the story of Chicago, and I want to tell you my own personal story. I often say that a Rebbe loves his Talmidim. Professors at times are very cynical, jealous, I don't know what word to use. It's not the same relationship like a Rebbe and Talmud. I don't know, Charlie, maybe you had a better relationship if from Harvard they sent you to Reb Ephraim Katzir and he influenced you. I want to give him covet. But, you know, he came from a frum home. You're aware of that. That generation, everyone, but there was no frum kind that wasn't developed how to continue. So, why is a Rebbe so friendly with his Talmidim? Because a Rebbe knows the future depends upon his Talmidim. If I don't raise great individuals, great Rabbanim, great Lamdanim, there is no tomorrow. So a Rebbe understands this is our Zukunft, our future. A professor, on the other hand, there may be personal reasons. This kid is smarter than I am. He's going to succeed me. He's going to be more famous. They didn't learn Musa. It doesn't mean a professor studied with Reb Yisrael Salanter. So when I finished my doctorate, I couldn't believe it. They called me in after the defense, the oral defense. And Rabbi Dr. Lander gets up, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. And everyone, they shake my hands, and one professor says to me, I know the way you guys work, this will be the last research you'll ever do. B'zeh HaLashon. And that really hurt. Number one, it's a time you finish a doctorate, give a guy mazel tov, don't be critical, don't be cynical. All right, but he was critical, he was cynical, and I took the challenge, and 66, 67, 2 years after my doctorate, I published postdoctoral research, which won an award. I don't want to go further about the award, it's not important, but I did postdoctoral research on the Ritbaz in Chicago. Now, this appeared in a very prestigious journal, Publications of the American Jewish Historical Society. I republished it in Rakafar Aram Chelik 2, Chelik Bet, beginning on page 154. And I want to elaborate. Now, what happened in Chicago, let's talk about the Ritbaz first. The Ritbaz was a very famous name. To put him, first of all, to give you his real name, it's Reb Yaakov David Volofsky. That was the family name. He later hebraized his name Ritbaz, Reb Yaakov David Ben Zev. You follow? His father was Zev, so he became Ritbaz. His years, 1845 to 1913. Now, the Ritbaz was Slutzker Rav, he was in Ely. Photographic memory. But what made him famous, and you have to understand this, there are many Rabbanim who are very great, but they don't go out of their Dalar Amad. No one really knows about them. No one has contact with them. I'm sorry, I'm breaking into Yiddish, but this is a world that speaks Yiddish, and I'm reliving it. Minzitzten avinkel. You know what that means, Aryeh? Minzitzten avinkel. You stay in a little corner. You know, it's like Reb Chaim Kanievsky. People come to him all over the world, but it took a long time till people knew who he was. The Ritbaz organized the yeshiva in Slutsk. That yeshiva becomes world famous. Some of you learned there, have relatives there, myself included. The Slutsky yeshiva, he turned to Reb Nutan Zvi Finkel of Slabodka, and he asked, this is 1896, this is the famous story, he asked Reb Nutan Zvi Finkel, who was very generous. I don't know if YU would be so generous if another type of, if Lander College turned to YU and said, give us 10 good students to start. I don't know why you would be so generous. It's an interesting question. But the Reb Nutan Zvi Finkel, whose main interest was to see that everyone is learning Torah, sent, it's called the Yad HaZakah, 14 top students from Slabodka to Slutsk. You had sitting in the classroom Rabbi Zev Goldberg, that's a grandson of one of the 14 whom he's named for, Rabbi Zev Goldberg. You're related, Vic winds up, the greater Mishpacha, fine. There were among them was Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. It's a whole list of giants who became giants later in the Torah world. So that put Slutsk on the map. And now, I'll just talk about the yeshiva, then I want to come back to the Ritbaz. What makes that so important and so tangible is that after World War I, Slutsk had to get out of White Russia, communist takeover. So they went across the border to Poland, and the yeshiva was reorganized in Kletsk. When it was reorganized in Kletsk, the Rosh Yeshiva at that point was Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, the Talmud of the Ritbaz, who had come in 1896. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who had tremendous Zionist tendencies, love of Eretz Yisrael, came in Aliyah. I believe it was 23 when he came. And at that point, his son-in-law, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, succeeded him. And Rabbi Aaron Cutler, until his dying day, was known, yes, he went in Aliyah until 1923. Rabbi Aaron Cutler, until his dying day, was known as the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva. That's the yeshiva that Rabbi Aaron reorganized in Lakewood in 1942-43. It was the continuity of the Kletzker Yeshiva. Morty's father-in-law was a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron in Kletzk. So, you see, when you organize a yeshiva, Yosef, welcome. When you organize a yeshiva, it becomes very well-known, and you become well-known. So the Ritbaz was very well-known. But that's not the only reason he was well-known. When you publish, everyone in the world, particularly you go into the world of scholarship, professors, you all know that if you publish or perish, that's the expression. And sometimes they publish wonderful things. Sometimes in scholarship they publish because they have to publish because they want people to know they're publishing, and they come up with theories that you can laugh your head off. You got to walk away, close the room, and just laugh for the next 23 hours. And I know, Morty, am I right or wrong? I can give you examples from my world, but let me not paint anyone else negative. I know one person who's dear to me, he came up with a third yeshiva, Surapam, Elohayav, Elohim Nivra, and everyone in the field walks around, they're laughing at him. I say, the man is a genius, all right, but they're laughing because he came up with something off the wall. Fine. The Ritbaz came up with something that no one could laugh at, no one could criticize, no one could put down. Gentlemen, how many of you have studied Yerushalmi? Yerushalmi was a closed book until Schottenstein opened it for the world now, for one simple reason. How do we know Bavli? May I quote the Rav to you? Everyone talks about the Rambam, but without Rashi we wouldn't understand one word of the Gemara. Quote, end quote. You heard that from the Rav Yitzchak or not? And the Rav, was the Rambam was his life, Reb Chaim. But let's be honest, the Rambam, beautiful. But without Rashi, how do you know how to learn? How do you know how to work out a sukkah? So we lack Rashi on the Yerushalmi. The Ritbaz undertook to write a dual perush, one like Rashi and one like Tosfat. He was called the Tana Yerushalmi. That was his nickname. That was his nomenclature. Everyone called him the Tana Yerushalmi. Then the Ritbaz published it. I need not tell you our Yerushalmi with a commentary and a super commentary.
He did all the Yerushalmi?
All the Yerushalmi. It made, and he published it, invested a fortune, raised money from the Rothschilds, went all over, borrowed, stole what he had to go through. Okay, it's now very famous. But because he published Yerushalmi, he now started traveling and raising money. He was in Germany, he was in France, he was in England, and finally in 1900, he comes to America visiting to raise money. I need not tell you, the American Jews, the Europäische, they still remembered Europe. They were only in America 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. Europe was their home. You all know where you all grew up. I grew up in the Bronx. Well, what's my home? My wife always says, we have dual status, dual identity. We're never going to be total Israelis. We're always going to go back to the Bronx Zoo, Yankee Stadium, where we were raised. This is natural. This is normal. Lech lecha meyatzecha. I got to bite my lips not to give all my different Torah on it. But this is normal. So the Ribaz comes to America. People waited online to hear him speak. They sponsored him. Even the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, which was not East European, it was very partially East European, even they sponsored him. And he was very sharp, very bright, and he was very upset at what he saw in America. And he made statements, for instance, this you've heard quoted, requoted, it's the Ribaz who said it. He actually said it when speaking on the sponsorship of the Orthodox Union. He said, America, Azaland, it's such a country, afilu de shtena zayim treif. Even the stones are treif. And this was a double intenda, because when you talk about stones, how do you kasha? No, you have a pot, you have to kasha. How did we kasha? We used to heat up water in the pot, take a stone that we heated up on fire, and drop the stone into the pot that the water should overflow. Today, they don't use stones, they use metal, they heat up metal. All right, today we don't kasha altogether. We're wealthy enough, we can buy three for Pesach. I still see kashering here on the streets. I'm amazed. You see people kashering, even in Rehavia, I mean, fancy neighborhoods, people with money. People are kashering. I say, well, you're kashering. So they tell me, you have no place to store it. All right, that there is some truth to that. But I know I don't have the kasha for Pesach. Who has the kasha? We have everything. But when you kasha, I feel the shtena, the stones are treif. And no one ever, he was never forgiven for that remark, as you will see. And then he saw the reverence, the people speaking in the shuls, and he was furious. And he paskind la halacha, if someone gets up to speak in the shul, you're davening in English. You're to walk out and not remain in the shul. And you see in his svarim that he wrote later, Shelet and Shivet, you got to read his introduction. I give you all the sources in the article. He describes, he says, they speak about nothing. They tell stories. They talk local politics. This is not dashanut. This is not speaking. This is not our future. And the minute you get involved with English, you wind up with Reform Judaism. And wow, he was very upset with what he saw in the United States. Walk out. Ad kedei kach. More than that, he saw the Hebrew schools, the Talmud Torah, and he said all they're interested in is that the kid should know how to say Kaddish. You follow? Make the bracha on the Torah for his bar mitzvah and know how to say Kaddish. Everything we said until now, you can manage, okay, the stones are treif, the rabbanim are worth, the reverence are worthless, but there's one area where you need help. You can't do it alone. Kashrut. You have to have kosher food. And here, he was ballistic. He describes a sheikhid in New York who, Friday night, after he finished all the shechting, went to the Yiddish theater. And you got to remember, the Jewish theater, much has been written about this, doctorates have been done. They were the most intellectually influencing influence on the east side of New York. I remember my grandparents had subscriptions, the Jewish theater. They weren't exactly pro-Torah, they weren't exactly pro-decency. Some of their funniest plays were off color. And Friday night, the sheikhid goes. He describes, and this the Rav had in Boston, he describes the sheikhid dakot. Remember, you never saw this. I saw it. Maybe some of the older people here saw it. on Bathgate Avenue in the Bronx on Thursday, thousands of chickens were slaughtered. Friday morning, hundreds of chickens slaughtered for Shabbos. The women took them home, kashered them. It was a different world. You had a shayla, your kid ran to the rav with the chicken. And he describes this shochet who slaughtered over 1,000 chickens beginning Thursday evening through Thursday night through Friday morning. And he said Shabbos, his hand was so tired, his children had to help him eat. He couldn't lift the spoon, couldn't lift the fork. Now I ask you, could the shechita be kosher? The last, if he slaughtered, let's say, 1,000 chickens, what about the last 300? You know how you have to slaughter a chicken and there has to be, you can't stop in the middle, no drisa, etc. And take a look. And the rug, by the way, had this in Boston. So he visited America, he raised money, he was sick of America, went back to Europe, and everyone felt they wouldn't see him again. But you see, once you get the wanderlust in you, it's there. He was no longer happy in Europe. He was no longer happy just to be in Kletz. He saw the bigger world, the greater world. He had a dream. He also, these were all hidden Zionists, although with the Ritvaz, it's more in the open, I would say. These were, Rabbi Zalman later lives at a time when there's an Agudat Yisrael, so he's in the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. The Ritvaz dies before Agudat Yisrael. But he has this dream of settling in Eretz Yisrael, settling in Palestine. How will he do it? You need money. He's broke, has no money. He owes money yet on what he published. And in 1903, he visits America again. Only this time, there is an Agudat HaRabbanim in America. And before his arrival in the Yiddish press, there is a letter published by Rav Avram Yaakov Gershon Leiser of Cincinnati, the most famous, most influential, most revered Rav in America, and he welcomes the Gadol Hadar to the United States.
His name is Leiser or Lesser?
It's interesting. The name originally was Lisa, but in America it's Lesser. He always signed Lisa, the Europäische way, Lamed Yud Samach Aleph, Hanoda Be'atzot Abrit, Lesser, Lion Lamed Ayin. You follow?
Yeah.
Check. He came to Cincinnati, what we say, 1870s. Check if they're related. You're related to the Lesser family, right or wrong? Dov Lesser, Zichrona Levracha. So, wow, he greets him warmly, and he's overjoyed, and they're paving the way to accept him in America. Don't go back, stay. The Agudas HaRabbanim, at their annual convention, their second convention in 1903, selects unanimously the Ritvaz, give him a special title, like the Sfadim, what's the word they use? Maran. Who is Maran, Mark? Rav Ovadia Yosef? Every secular newspaper, every radio, television, Maran, they don't even say, even the Goyim know Maran means Rav Ovadia Yosef. The Ritvaz becomes Zekan HaRabbanim of America. The Elder Rav, the top Rav, Rav Leiser, everyone recognizes his greatness. And finally, he visits various communities, he speaks, he comes to Chicago, and in Chicago, they plead with him, a number of shuls, remain here, we need you, we want you, you are our rabbi. He acquiesces, and here begins a very, very difficult story, which is worthy of a movie, but a story which captures the era, the period, the human beings, and problems that are real, tangible, nothing to do with who you are, what you are, the reality of life. And let me explain myself. Most of the meat in America came from the Midwest at that time. I don't know what the story is today. It probably is still the same story, but I'm not an expert. The Midwest, cattle country, tremendous slaughterhouses, names that you've heard of, grew up with, Armour and Company, Schwarzschild and Sitzberger and Company, Libby McNeil and Company, Swift and Company, at least three of these names I grew up with. There's no such thing as a kosher slaughterhouse. What the kosher slaughter did, they would rent space from the general slaughterhouse. And there would be times designated when it was kosher slaughter. Needless to say, 20%, 30% of the kosher slaughter was found to be treif. Percentage-wise, I remember the Rav once got hysterical at what they called glatt kosher because he felt their percentage of tafis was not enough to be called glatt kosher. But I don't know, an expert would tell you. My own feeling is that the tafis runs something like 23, 24%. So that immediately is pushed aside into the treif part of the slaughterhouse. And it's not a total loss. It's not like Europe, where if a kosher butcher slaughtered and the animal was treif, basically it was a total loss. Here, you have a big slaughterhouse. They're more than happy to accept meat that was slaughtered kosher and was declared treif. And I had this problem, you won't believe your ears or your eyes, I see it in front of me. Suddenly in Maplewood, New Jersey, the local butcher, I see a sign up, this has to be 62, 63, I see a sign up, kosher liver. Kosher liver. So I go into the store, I tell him, no, all this meat was slaughtered kosher. I say, but this is a treif butcher. I said, I'm checking whether there are laws. I immediately got in touch with a lawyer. He told me that there's a law that we can close this place down. This was early 60s. He backed off. All the signs were gone. But what did he mean by kosher slaughter? It was a chab. Kosher slaughter. Taka was slaughtered kosher. But the animal was found to be an availer or a trafer. You follow? He was not lying, but it was not kosher.
It could be an availer.
The other was found. It was a treifer. Fine, you're right. You're right. At least with the liver, it certainly has to be a treifer. The slaughter was kosher, or it could be nitbal balah before the slaughter. Something went wrong. All right, there can be many, many. What about if the shchiter is not a good shchiter, etc.? At that point, it's an availer, not a treifer, I believe. But say that you get the point. He's advertising kosher. And why kosher? Because the average Gentile believes that anything kosher is cleaner than anything treif. And you should know that this belief may absolutely be correct. It spurs the kosher market. In America today, there are people who have nothing, not even Jews, but they will only buy kosher. I saw this in South Africa. I couldn't believe my eyes. There was a big canyon, how do you say, a shopping center, and four tremendous kosher restaurants. I said, how many Jews do you have here? They said, look in, see who's eating there. Three quarters of the people were certainly not Jewish, unless all Africans who are dark are Jewish. Three quarters were not Jewish. Three quarters. Why are they eating here? Kosher. It's cleaner. It's better. To export from South Africa, I was told you must have a heksha. I said, what are you talking about? Because they want to sell all over the world. People see a product from South Africa, their attitude is, that's a primitive country. They see a heksha, clean. Good? We can buy it. I remember the Shuk Machne Yehuda, There are candy places there with candy from all over the world. Well, you have to know if you're Makpid and Chalav Yisrael, some of it is, but it all has Isher Rabbanut, other candy. So I saw, evidently, Balei Tshuva, and they're looking at the candy brought in from South Africa. Very good candy. Now I cut down on sugar, so I can't enjoy this, but we manage. I don't know if I cut down on sugar because I have to or because the doctor says, when you grow older, it's better not to eat so much sugar. Could be that's why. Okay. So I hear them talking, and the white, and you know, the man, and he said, oh, it has a badatz. Says to his wife, we can use it. And by the way, he was right. That he thought it's a badatz, you know, Yerushalayim. It's the badatz of South Africa. But their badatz is a very good hechshu. I think it's even makpid on Chalav Yisrael. I think in England too they makpid on a hechshu and Chalav Yisrael. Not the way we are with the OU that we give to everything. And I'm not criticizing you, chas v'chalila. I also am not makpid. But very interesting. So you see these slaughterhouses were massive. This was a big industry. Now, Kolzman, Rabbi Lessa, was in Chicago. He was the Rav HaMachshir. No one argued with him. He was the authority. He went to Cincinnati. He left the vacuum. The Sheikhtim got together, and they hired one of the local Rabbanim, Rab Shimon Tzvi Album. And he is to be the Rav HaMachshir. Now I'll talk about Rav Album a little later, if not today, next week. I want you to understand, he was a terrific Talmud Chacham. But he certainly wasn't as famous as the Ritbaz, who had organized the yeshiva, who published on the Yerushalmi. He had been in America years earlier, and this was his main source of income, the slachtis. In the contract he made with the Sheikhtim, and this becomes the main point of contention, the contract read that the Sheikhtim are totally under his supervision, have to follow him faithfully. The Sheikhtim are not allowed to show the slaughter knives to any other Rabbanim unless Rabbi Album and his assistant Rav Komisarsky permit them to. Now what are we talking about slaughter knives? Those of you that are going to be Sheikhtim, and over the years we raised here in the Kollel a number of individuals who became Sheikhtim. One of my Talmidim worked for the OU, may still work for the OU. For many years, Pendada, Pennsylvania, the main thing is Sheikhet, besides mastering the act of Shechita, the most important part that he has to master is how to fine-tune, to hone, to sharpen the shechita knife. There can be no pagima. Did you ever see a rav check a shechita knife? You need a nice nail, a nice nail. You have to rub it. You have to be sure there's no pagima. Vic, if you put it under a microscope, you will find there is a pagima. But you understand what I'm saying? Lo nitna Torah l'malchei asharet. It means a human being feels it is good, it is straight, it is sharp. There is no indentation, if that may be the English word for pagima. Basically, Yosef, you should know this is basic to halacha. The same thing with tefillin. There has to be, right? You need a square. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, how can you have an exact square? And you suggest, he says, lo nitna Torah l'malchei sharet. What appears to the eye is sufficient. The same thing with the vegetables, what went on with checking, with light tables, that is pure amraset. You understand? It's to the human being, to the human eye. You're going to start looking under a microscope. You can't drink a cup of water. It's filled with micro, with the, what do they call them? What's the word? Micro something. microorganisms, but there's no end. God created a world for humans to live. Okay? But the knife is very, very important. And the sheikhdom cannot show the knife without the permission of the supervising rabbanim. Now, the Ribaz comes into Chicago. He is world famous. He is the Zakan HaRabbanim, the eldest Rav in America, meaning the most learned Rav. The Agudat HaRabbanim stands in awe of him. And he's coming to Chicago, and he shouldn't be able to examine the knives, and World War III breaks out.
Why did he have to do that?
He wanted to be certain the Shechita is on a level that he can approve.
Is he
Rabbi Albin, he wanted to be certain. Let's say he didn't know Rabbi Albin. This was someone that he just met when he comes to Chicago. He's coming from Europe, acknowledged as the Gadol Hadar. He wants to be certain it's on a level. And World War III started. And that's the story. The machloket was endless. Rabbi Albin's people, Ashim Blatter, I don't know how to say that in English, but all types of dirt and schmutz they threw at the Ritbaz. And the Ritbaz's people, we want proper hashkacha, we want to be certain, we want to be sure. Rabbi Albin said, anyone can examine the knives without permission when they want to see our high standard of hashkacha, but not when they're here to create machloket, strife and fight. And that's the famous story the Ritbaz saw, it's impossible, tradition, anecdotal tradition, I'll show you next week, I'm not the only one to quote it, it evidently was so widely known that others quoted as well. He went into the Schlachthuis on a Friday afternoon, I told you, and he couldn't get out, they locked him in the freezer. Finally, Friday night, he broke his way out, went home, grabbed his family, got on the train, and got out of Chicago on Shabbos Pikuach Nefesh. Whether it's true or not, no one can guarantee, but I have a feeling there is truth to the story. It's more than anecdotal, because I've heard it, and I'll show you a source next week. Now, he gets to New York, and the Ritbaz is trying to find himself. We know that he was involved, situated at Yeshiva Reb Yitzchok Chanan, and that would have been a natural place for him to hang his hat. This is a Yudapeyeshi yeshiva. Everyone there is a greenhorn. I don't think there's one American-born student there yet. That only comes later, Saul B. Friedman. And we know he was at Yeshiva Reb Yitzchok Chanan. How do we know it? Because he gave a certain letter of haskama to a certain rav, approving a sefer he was issuing, and the haskama letter is written on the stationery of Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan. However, that was only a stop. It was not a lasting influence. 1905, the Ritbaz achieved his dream and settled in Tzvat, where he became the Rav of Tzvat till the day he died in 1913. You all know about the Ritbaz. Every kid growing up in Israel, all of you that have cousins here and children here, and every kid knows about the Ritbaz, because when the Shemitah year comes, we face the tremendous dilemma, should we be somach on the Cheta, yes or no? And the Ritbaz was the big bar pelukta with Rav Kook. Rav Kook, you all know, accepted the Cheta, Reb Yitzchok Chanan Inspector, Reb Yeshua Kutna, Reb Shmuel Moliver, the Mechirat, part of the land, I'll say, to non-Jews, what type of malacha you could do, and to be able to do it with Shinui, without Shinui. I need not tell you how much has been written, But in the Rav Kook world, essentially the chetta was accepted. We try our best to minimize the chetta and try to bring us to a plateau one day when we can observe the Shemitah properly. But so far we have not been able to achieve it. Although, there, if you know, Rav Yisrael Rosen just died. He came up with instruments to use in farming, where I believe they use a grummer. It's not directly what you're doing, but you touch something, the machine does it later. And I remember there were pictures of Rav Gorin looking at it and being very impressed, all these ideas. But nevertheless, it's not the Shemitah in the sense the land is fallow and everyone is studying Torah. But the Ribaz was the Bar Pulukta of Rav Kook. And it was, again, bitter battles during the two Shemitah, I believe, that the Ribaz was in Eretz Yisrael. And everyone knows him because of that machloket. I'll end off with one story that not everyone knows. The second chief rabbi of the land of Israel was Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. He succeeded Rav Kook. All right, these were chief rabbis. It was a different era, different times. These were Rabbanim Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. Rav Herzog never went to yeshiva. His father was rabbi of the Haredi Shul, so-called, in Paris, Rabbi Yoel Herzog. And he grew up in France, later in England. He marries the Avbeiten Rav Shmuel David Hillman's daughter, Sarah Avbeiten of London. You all know that Rav Herzog spoke fluently 9-10 languages, had a doctorate in marine biology from London University. We're dealing with a giant. He also had a photographic memory, a new Kol HaTorah Kula Baal Peh. All the Rashi Yeshiva here used to meet with Rav Herzog Friday morning in his home on Rehov Ibn Ezra. He would give a shir, and this Rav Yashub was there, Rav Orbach was there, one after another, Rav Tokachinsky. He was lauded for his unbelievable bekiyut and insight. Also had insight. He knew the world as it was. So Rav Herzog met when the Ribaz visited France, Paris, to raise money for his Yerushalmi Talmud. Rav Herzog was a little kid growing up, and he became enamored of the Ribaz. The Ribaz loved him. They spoke in learning, and they were kinship souls. And later he got smicha from the Ribaz, and this was all without a direct classroom relationship. And 1913, Rosh Hashanah, Rav Herzog had a dream that the Sefer Torah is being burned in Tzfat. And after Rosh Hashanah, a telegram came that the Ribaz died. And it turned out that the minute of that dream was when the Ribaz died. Shows you what the kinship was. So this was the Ribaz. All right, all of you have sided with the Ribaz. Next week, I want to talk about Rabbi Album. And you'll see real problems. And there's a sideshow next week with Rabbi Album, which will open your eyes to a story of America that... It's beyond comprehension. I wish there's some young... Arye, could you bring in a few youngsters here who want to do movies on Torah history? The Rebbe will give them information, insight, a little guidance, and I won't charge anything, I promise you. Okay?
The man you should see is Beryl White, because he puts out every year...
If you come into my office, you will see a note that I want to call his right hand, my dear student, Rabbi Normie Amsel,
right,
for many reasons. But you remember, last year they videoed me for one of Beryl Ryan's projects. Yeah. But Rabbi Wein is on in years, as you know, I understand, Yitzchak, you're talking, I have to deal with Normie Amsel. You're giving me Rabbi Beryl Wein. I have to deal with Normie Amsel. That you and I are still in Bnei Akiva, this is a miracle of our existence. That Mindaf Dankin the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. You follow me? Up and out and active. Kanayin hara. You should see what I'm preparing. I need another good few years to get to it. I'm working on Slabutka now. That's fascinating material. Slabutka. Gentlemen, to reiterate, I have a lot of freebies, but let's first reiterate. What did we do? Was haben wir getan heim? Remember the Rav? What did we do today?
One second. We see that Rabbi Albert was not a Russian. Neither was he. I would say he was the leader here.
Yitzchak, you suffer.
The Gadol comes in, and you say, okay, the Gadol has the right to do it.
Yitzchak,
this was his prognosis.
Yitzchak, you suffer from an Israeli disease known as sublenitis. Next week is next week. David should keep us in health. And we will get there, and you will be very happy. But leave that for next week. And I'll show you sources.
I mean, it's a shame because the Rabbis could have started the yeshiva in Japan.
Relax.
You could have organized the Rabbis.
It took a long time to leak.
You're right.
You're absolutely right. But it took a long time till we got to the point that people were totally ashamed. Shemayim and didn't have to worry about Parnassus.
The whole thing that made the Rav gave him a heart rate and anxiety was the Kashrut.
No, the Kashrut don't
cause the whole thing.
The Kashrut almost almost destroyed him, and we're fortunate that the Rav overcame and remained where he remained. You know, he remained where they tarred and feathered him in your community, Boston. The Rav saved that. You don't have to. Rakefet quotes the Rav word by word saying that. I owe my life to Yeshiva University, and he explains why. Gentlemen, so what did we do today? We're dealing with the Igodes Rabbanim 1902, and the convention ends, the Vat HaPoel, and we're talking about the great achievement of RJJ, which is not to be underestimated. Today, everyone has a day school. This was one of the earliest day schools in America. It probably was the second day school, and it's the first that remained a day school until this very moment. So many, Eitz Chaim, which merges with Yeshivas with Chochanan, which ultimately becomes a school for older boys. And then we got involved with Chicago. We traced half the picture. We still have another half to go. I just want to mention that, again, I'll elaborate. People ask me, Shvutami is honoring me, and I've agreed to be honored because it's to raise money for Russian Jewry to do good things in Russia and good things here. If you notice, Yomo is walking with stars in his eyes today. Shvutami is giving him a challenge to organize something here. And Shyomo sat with me in this room at 8 o'clock this morning. If 1/10 of what he told me about comes through, I'm dancing a Kazatsky, Billy Netta. You should hear his plans. I mean, Yomo is Yomo. You got to give credit. Anyway, there's a Malava Malka in Ranana. It's the Shabbos Chanukah when I don't teach. Saturday, December 15th, 2017, it's at that night, and they're honoring a Rebbe and Talmud. And I'm going to be in Ranana. I'm going to speak Friday night, Shabbos, Sunday morning as well. If you need details, go downstairs to Sherry's office. It's blown up, and you can copy the phone number, the email, and get all the details. Who is this Talmud? Harry M. Dura. Gentlemen, these two little microphones in front of me, recorders, it's a new world. The Rebbe Leket Shichacha and Peya. Do you know what you're dropping, what you're losing? The poor man comes along and picks it up. What a schut you have. And you know nothing, right or wrong. Shichacha. Okay? I cannot tell you how many emails I have from people who write to me that these shurim changed their lives. I have a whole collection. I'm not boasting, chas v'chalila. I should have accomplished a lot more in my life considering the great people I knew intimately, as you will see. But this Talmud, Harry M. Dura, born in Manchester, raised in Manchester, wanted to come to BMT early 70s, told his father, I heard there's this great school, Zionist after the Six-Day War, religious Zionism, and his father told him over my dead body, do you go to BMT, a Zionist school, and sent him to a what you call a Haredi institution near Manchester, later, you know, that whole area. Anyway, he's a very bright fellow. He married the Rosh Yeshiva's daughter and had two children. At the age of 30, he threw away, gave his wife a get, threw away Yiddishkeit, off the derech, as they say, next 10 years, lived in London, went into business, did well, and when he turned 40, he started asking, who am I, what is the blood in my veins? And someone in London told him, go to yutorah.org, Rosh Yeshiva, a guy named Rakhafet. And as they say, the rest is history. Now he starts doing business in Israel, and he becomes very close to Merkaz HaRav and the Rosh Yeshiva of Yaakov Shapiro, and he has a business deal coming down. He told the story in the Kollel about 10, 15 years ago. Were any of you here? Before I walked into class, suddenly everyone jumped up for me like Rav Soloveitchik walked in. I looked at them, and then I saw Harry. So I knew already. I said, oh, he told you the story. So he's tells Rabbi Yaakov, look, I have this big deal coming down, and even though I know Hebrew, I want an English speaker to be with me in case I have to translate a word on the contract I'm signing. So the Rosh Yeshiva says, no problem, I'll send my chavruta, the young man I'm learning with. Sends the young man, they sit, the business deal, everything completed, and they go out to a cafe to celebrate, and he says to the young man, where were you born? And this young man says, Yerushalayim. He says, how do you know English so well? So this young kid says, look, my grandparents came in Aliyah many years ago, and they spoke English to my mother, and my mother insisted on speaking English to us, and it's like I have two native languages. Who are your grandparents? He said, well, you wouldn't know them. My grandfather teaches. What's his name? Well, people know him as Harav Aaron Rakhefet, and Harry faints. When they revive him, he says to my grandson, can we call your grandfather? No, like I'm a rebbe, like surrounded by 550 gabayim. And I get a call, and I met him. And he told me the story, and as they say, the rest is history. He organized the kollel in Ranana, where he lives, with his wife, his second wife, who he married very nicely, beautiful family. Beautiful couple, and Kollel is named in memory of his father. Beautiful thought. He's very published a sefer already in Nachayim. He dedicates it in Mayani. You can see the sefer, and this is the affair. But I agree to it not because I need honor, but because I want to help Shvatami. And Harry was anxious to do something, so I told him, let's do something for Shvatami. If anyone is listening to me over the world, particularly in Israel, our greatest tragedy is, in my opinion, these kids who leave Yiddishkeit and throw Kol HaTorah Kulo away. It breaks my heart. I admit, in my world, the kids who leave Yiddishkeit don't throw it all away. They are living, you know, make merry, have fun, tomorrow we'll be dead. Maybe when their eyes open and they've had their fill of wine, women, and song, they'll come back, b'lev shalem, and say, what idiots we were to leave Torah Hashem. But the Haredi world, they leave and they throw it all away. So in America, there's an organization to help every Haredi kid who leaves to turn you into a guy. A counter-organization was just formed called Makom. And I met with a lady. It was an unbelievable experience when I was in Riverdale. A Belza Hasida threw it away, but now Makom is helping her, trying to tell her, you don't have to throw it all away. You don't have to be Haredi. You could, she has a degree already, and you'll be a total. And she met with Malcolm myself, and she was overwhelmed. I couldn't believe my ears. Overwhelmed with our dedication to Yiddishkeit. I looked at her, dedication, we're Jews. And yet she's read, her life was around the Rebbe. Nothing, all right? It's a Now in Israel, can we organize a makom? Here's an article that appeared in last week's paper about this kid. Yitzia El Ha'ar, Yitzhati Elai, went out to the light. Kid from Rabara Lamei Sharim. He's in the Israeli army. Beautiful. But why did you have to throw away the Torah? An organization, Hallel, I think it's called, or Hillel, whatever, it helps them leave Torah. We need an organization like Makom. You don't have to be Haredi to serve God as a total Torah, complete, absolute Torah Jew. Please organize it and reach out to these kids. If anyone wants the article, it's yours. Charlie, this is about your relative. Whole piece. This is the Lord's Prayer by a 15-year-old school kid who got an A+ for it. The Lord's Prayer is not allowed in many United States public schools anymore. A kid in Minnesota wrote the following school prayer. Now I sit me down in school where praying is against the rule. For this great nation under God finds mention of him very odd. If scripture now the class recites, it violates the Bill of Rights. And any time my head I bow becomes a federal matter now. Our hair can be purple, orange, or green. That's no offense. It's a freedom scene. The law is specific. The law is precise. Prayers spoken aloud are a serious vice. For praying in a public school might offend someone with no faith at all. In silence alone we must meditate. God's name is prohibited by the state. We're allowed to cuss and dress like freaks and pierce our noses, tongues, and cheeks. They've outlawed guns, but first the Bible, to quote the good book, makes me liable. We can elect a pregnant senior queen and the unwed daddy our senior king. It's inappropriate to teach right from wrong. We're taught that such judgments do not belong. We can get our condoms and birth control, study witchcraft, vampires, and totem poles. But the Ten Commandments are not allowed. No word of God must reach this crowd. It's scary here, I must confess. When chaos reigns, the school's a mess. So Lord, this solemn plea I make, should I be shot, my soul please take. Wow.
You made more copies of it. We can all have a copy.
Everyone wants, okay, I'll make more copies, give it out. That's next week. Nice. Unbelievable. Okay, so leave this here. Ah, this story, 1977, my undercover Shabbos in Queens Heights. It's about a girl from Maplewood, New Jersey, from a Reform temple. Goes to Chabad for Shabbos, stays at the home of the Groners, and changes her whole life. Very, very moving for me, because it's Maplewood. A beautiful story, again, from Queens, Rego Park, Jews from Russia. The Chabad representative pleads with them to have a proper marriage, and finally they do, and he gets their whole family background. And it turns out they're great-grandchildren of one of the most famous Chabad Mashpiyim. Unbelievable what you turn out. Yeshiva Topin, a Muslim city. This is in the former Soviet Union. It's the birthplace of the fifth city of Kazan. They're reopening a yeshiva. They're Tomchei Tamimim. Take a look what they're doing. This is unbelievable where we're living, that, what was it, the University of Pennsylvania, I believe, deputy foreign minister grew up, and Morty Carrigan saw her from little girl to womanhood. Sippy Chovatova, how do you pronounce the last name?
Chotaveli.
Sippy Chotaveli. She's scheduled to speak there. And at Princeton, unbelievable. And the director of Hillel, a Reform woman rabbi, cancels her speech. She's not Jewish. She's a rightist. And Chabad House, opened their house to her at Princeton, and that's where she spoke. Hard to believe. This is about Avi Weiss, the greatness of Avi Weiss. This is what the memoir when he took on the mayor Dinkins during the riots in East, in Crown Heights. And remember, years and years ago, what's it, 20 years ago, this is Avi Weiss at his finest. What a story, 25 years ago. Wow, I remember this, although I lived here, it reached the press here. Now, this is very interesting, and I leave you to think about it. We use time clocks. You can't drive on Shabbos, but can a self-driving car help you? Okay, it's a whole article here. Interesting, but I don't think that's feasible because no matter you're going to get into the car, there's going to be Chilul Shabbos.
There's no muktzah.
Well, muktzah, how do you define muktzah? If you just sit down and the car moves by itself, why aren't you allowed to sit on the
seat?
How
does it know where you want to go?
You program it before Shabbos. Say that. I'm not happy. But now let me ask a more serious question. And by the way, this appeared in... I think it's 2 weeks ago in Makor Rishon. Tell me, driving to shul on a bicycle, mutter, not mutter?
Shabbos.
Shabbos. Yeah. During the week, what's the shaila?
Okay. There also.
An Arab.
No trees around.
Gentlemen, here it's the same trip. I have two copies. Biking to shul on Shabbos. Written by Rav Chaim Ovadia, Magen David Sfadik congregation, based upon the Ben Ish Chai, is matir, and using the bicycle Shabbos. There's a world of material here. And here's the article that Rabbi Birnbaum reaches Deal, New Jersey, and he sees on Shabbos people are driving on their bicycle, and based upon the Chivit, based upon the Ben Ish Chai. Interesting question. I have a feeling I have a dear student who feels he's in favor of it. Yours truly, I haven't made my peace with it. I somehow feel that the bicycle, everyone bicycling, it's like Yom Kippur here with the Chiloniyim, bicycle on Yom Kippur. And it there on Yom Kippur, I say to myself, be happy they're not driving, you understand? But here, no, how do you feel, Morty?
The same thing you see on Shabbos in the Haredi neighborhoods, all the kids riding scooters.
From a scooter to a bicycle, you say it's not that big a transition. Charlie, what do you say? What's your yucky feeling? By the way, you see who died, Rabbi Feldman of Beis Yaakov, Yira Tzadik with the... So you know what, you know what a small world it is? One of my greatest, the only student that I have this relationship with, Beryl Phillips, very unique. What's my unique relationship with him? I taught him, Charlie, before you were born, let's put it that way, 70, 71. We go back 90 years. My wife's mother taught his father. You understand? I have no other student that I can say that. So we're very close until today. Lo Aleinu, his first wife died. Carol, Zichrona Levracha, sweetheart. But the Rebbe Shlomo that runs the world, we don't run it. He remarried. You know who he's married to? Her maiden name is Friedman. I never put two and two together. Pearl Friedman, she just said Shiva for her brother. You have no idea who we're talking about. This Rabbi Friedman, based out of Baltimore, every child with special needs, he arranged. A blind girl graduated the high school, Beis Yaakov. I have good friends, their grandchildren all have hearing problems. It's genetic. It came from the father's side, the daughter married, whatever, genetic. All those kids with the hearing problems graduated Beis Yaakov. This is Rabbi Mendel Friedman, died mid-60s, died young. I believe he's a son-in-law to Rabbi Diskin, am I right? And he was a son-in-law to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, so he's married to a granddaughter of Rabbi Yaakov. Oh, these are great Jews. Right, he had a heart transplant. I read that. Gentlemen, I want to thank you all for your participation. I want to tell you again that December 3rd, I stop all my regular teaching and I go into a series of Hakarat HaTov. And above all, ani modeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu. I have to say, I mentioned it yesterday in class, I mentioned it again. Friday night I was invited out. I ate supper, Malka and I, we had asked permission of our daughter, because generally we eat there, but she understands. We were in Shari Chesed, and I was, I think, the outside of one lady whose husband went to Chevron, she gave him permission, Shabbos Pashat Chayesara. I said, you're lucky he didn't want to go to Uman. You understand? Chevron, at least he'll get back Saturday night. But I'm opposed to that. You leave your wife. I don't know, she was happy. Outside of that lady, I think I was the youngest person there. Get it? And my wife is younger than I am. That was it. And boy, I saw people growing older and the problems. Vic, pray to the Ribbono Shel Olam. We should all have a Arichat Yomim Tovim with health, with seichel, with a good mind.
In Israel they say, Admeya Ke'esri.
Exactly. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Okay, please take everything. This I'll make copies of. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile.
Very good.